Now, Dave and Morley gave the bird feeder to Stephanie last Christmas. I don't know, they thought it might distract her. They get her involved in the greater world around her. It was an unqualified failure. When she opened it on Christmas morning, Stephanie squinted at the bird feeder, frowned, and then checked the gift tag to see if she'd opened the wrong present. Is this a mistake? She asked with no enthusiasm. So it was Dave who ended up assembling the feeder, and Dave who filled it each day, every day through the dark mornings of January and February when the snow and ice was piled up in all of the provinces. It was Dave who beat the path from the back door to the bird feeder that sits on the pole in the center of his backyard. At first, the only birds interested in his efforts were a thuggish gang of sparrows. They flung Dave's bird seed onto the ground where it was pecked over by a bunch of pigeons who began to hang out under the bird feeder like a squad of squeegee kids. It's more like a shelter for the homeless than a bird feeder, said Morley. In the week between Christmas and New Year, Dave got a blue jay and a junco. In the first week of the new year, he got a gang of chickadees and some birds who seemed to be traveling with him. But the vast flocks of birds that he'd imagined avoided his feeder. It seemed to be serving no real need in the bird universe. And then on a chilly, gray Saturday in the middle of January, something came. Dave pointed it out to everyone at lunch. Over there, he said, see in the Lobeer's pine tree. Nobody was the least bit interested. It wasn't a big bird, not as big as a robin, and it had olive green above its wings and a dull yellow below. It seemed to favor the evergreen hedge that bordered his backyard. It would flick out of this thicket and peck at the seeds in the feeder tray and then vanish into the hedge again. Dave watched it for a week, and then one afternoon he asked Gerda Lobeer if she knew what kind of bird it was. Gerda brought her three bird books and her binoculars over, said it looks like a tanager, female summer tanager. But a summer tanager is not supposed to come this far north. Gerda's finger was moving along the small print of her bird book. In January, a summer tanager is supposed to be on a beach in Brazil. And it shouldn't eat seeds, said Gerda. A tanager eats insects and wasps. It's a carnivore. When Gerda left, Dave put out a few pieces of tangerine, the sort of thing you might expect to find if you're used to wintering in Brazil. Then he drove to a pet store to see if he could buy his bird some insects and wasps. He got a bag of crickets. And the bird fell onto the crickets like she hadn't seen a decent meal in months. That bird was starving, thought Dave. But as happy as she was with the crickets, Dave could see that she was having difficulty with them. They weren't going down easily. She was having trouble with their shells. It was 5:45. Dave drove back to the pet store and bought a bag of mealworms. Bird didn't stop eating until 9:30 that night. Only took the bird a week to train Dave. By the end of the week, they had... By the end of the week, they had worked out a routine they could both live with. A scoop of worms at breakfast, a scoop of fresh worms at lunch, and a scoop of worms at dinner. It meant Dave had to come home at noon. I don't mind, he said. And he didn't. Dave knew that if Gerda was right and if he stopped feeding this bird, it was going to die. By February, he had bought so many mealworms that the pet store was giving him a discount. But he felt a sense of pride about what he was doing, that the bird had chosen him. It was not long after Valentine's Day when Gerda mentioned the bird to her friend Nick, who she said was a bit of a birder. Nick came over that evening to see it for himself. He watched the bird for half an hour, and he says, I'm not sure. Do you mind if I call my friend Bob? Bob was there in less than an hour. He was wearing camouflage pants and a heavy sweater with a high neck. He was carrying a pair of binoculars and a canvas shoulder sack. He took one look at Dave's bird and asked if he could borrow the phone. Didn't even use his binoculars. I'm phoning from Toronto, he said. He was very excited, his right foot bouncing up and down. I'm in some guy's kitchen. He smiled at Dave, and then he looked at him quizzically. About 15 minutes from the Sky Dome, right? Dave nodded. You aren't going to believe this, he said into the phone. And then he looked at Dave's 8-year-old son, Sam, and he lowered his voice. We have got a serious CMF. And then he smiled into the phone and said, "A summer tanager." And then he hung up and he turned and he smiled at Dave and Sam. "What's a CMF?" said Sam. The man in the camouflage pants looked at Sam. Dave said, it isn't dangerous, is it? Sounded like it could be dangerous. The man shook his head. He said, it's just birder talk, he said. What does it stand for?" asked Dave. CMF, said the man. "It means cosmic mother..." "Flicker. Cosmic mother flicker." Sam grinned. Dave winced. "That's the bird of the winter you got there," said the man. He pulled his bird book out, the National Geographic Book of Birds. And he flipped open and he pointed at the bird on the page. Dave peered at the picture and he nodded. And the man said, "There's a few of my friends who would love to see it. Would that be okay?" Morley came home at 7. "Guess what we have in the backyard," said Sam. "What?" said Morley, throwing groceries on the kitchen counter. "A CMF," said Sam. "A what?" said Morley. "It's a cosmic mother..." Dave's hand flew out and covered his son's mouth. "We don't talk like that on this radio show," he said. "It's birder talk," said Sam. Morley looked at the two of them. She was waving a jar of ketchup. "What," she said, "is going on?" "The bird in the backyard," said Dave, "the one I've been feeding worms." "It's cosmic," said Sam. Morley rolled her eyes. "I'm beginning to hate that bird feeder," she said. That night, as Morley was brushing her teeth, Dave said, some people might drop by in the morning. "Who?" said Morley. To look at the bird," said Dave. "What bird?" said Morley. The bird I feed the mealworms to," said Dave. "It's supposed to winter in Brazil. It chose our backyard over Brazil. So people want to see it," said Dave, "because it's a rarity. It'll be okay. These are birders we're talking about. Nice people." "I don't want people poking around our backyard in the morning," said Morley. "Can't they wait until the weekend?" It was so early that the sun wasn't up the next morning when Dave heard the noise. And then it dawned on him. Somebody was stealing the bikes. He leapt out of bed and opened the curtains and squinted into the yard, and when his eyes finally focused, he gasped and stepped back from the window. There were maybe 50 motionless men lined up in the shadows behind his house. "Houston," he said, "we have a problem." Morley mumbled and rolled over, and Dave said, "Don't wake up. I need a plan before you wake up." It was 6:45 a.m. 15 minutes later, Sam's clock radio snapped on. "Here we go," thought Dave. "Liftoff." He was sitting at the kitchen table, not sure what he should do, but before he could do anything, the phone rang. It was Carl Lobier. "Dave," he said. He was whispering, "There's something terrible going on outside." Not as terrible, however, as what was going on at the Turlingtons. Two doors down from Dave's at the Turlingtons' house, Mary, Bert, and the Turlington twins were lying on the floor of Mary and Bert's bedroom with their hands over their head. At 5 to 7, one of the twins, I think it was Jonathan, had looked out his bedroom window to see if it was good snowball snow, and when he saw the men with the binoculars, he had run to his parents' bed and he said, "The house is surrounded by police. I think it's the SWAT team." Now, Bert, who is not what you'd call a morning person, nearly stroked out when he saw the men in the dark jackets with their binoculars trained at his kid's window. Bert dropped to the floor and crawled around his house, waking everyone up. "We're surrounded," he said. "Get into our bedroom, fast." And now the whole family was there except for Bert's 17-year-old son, Arthur, who had locked himself into the upstairs bathroom. Bert wormed his way into the hall and he pounded on the door. "What are you doing?" he howled. Arthur, who had never gotten up so fast in his life, was desperately trying to flush the first marijuana he'd ever bought down the toilet. He'd bought it 3 weeks ago from a kid at school, and he'd been afraid to smoke it. He'd hidden it in an old pair of sneakers in the back of his cupboard. Now the marijuana kept floating to the top of the toilet. And the police had surrounded the house, and they were going to arrest him any moment now. Arthur kept flushing, and Bert kept screaming. And then Bert inched his way back to the bedroom, and he pulled himself up to the... You okay? Bert inched himself... his way back to the bedroom, and he pulled himself up to the window, and he peered over the windowsill. There were cars everywhere, parked on both sides of the street and pulled up onto the sidewalk. Bert's heart was pounding. There were men who looked like they were carrying telescopes running down Dave's driveway towards his backyard. High-powered rifles, thought Bert. The Lobier's dog was barking. A man came running out of Dave's yard and pointed directly at Bert's house. Bert gasped and dropped to the floor. Blessed mercy, he said. We're going to die. 20 minutes later, Dave was still trying to explain things to the neighbors standing on his lawn. It was announced on some birders hotline, Dave was saying, when there was a sudden commotion at the Turlington's house. Dave stopped talking, and everyone turned just as the Turlington's front door flew open and the entire Turlington family burst out of their house. They'd wrapped themselves in a large white sheet. And they were moving down the sidewalk like a bunch of Shriners in a horse costume. And they all had their heads low. Even Bert, who was leading the way, waving one hand in the air and screaming at the same time, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot." That night at 11:30, Dave was standing on a ladder in his kitchen, tacking a sheet over the glass door that faced onto their backyard. "It'll be over soon," he said to Morley. "There can't be that many birders in Toronto." The phone rang at midnight. Dave and Morley stared at each other. Dave picked it up. "Who was it?" said Morley. "Some guy from Halifax asking if the bird's still here." "Halifax?" said Morley. "He said it. He'd be up on the weekend. He said he heard it was a mega twitch." Saturday morning at 9:30, when Dave came downstairs, there were already 15 people outside. By 10 o'clock, there were close to 100 people milling around Dave's house. Even though none of them was any further than 20 yards from the bird feeder, they had ringed it with binoculars and telescopes, many on tripods. One man on Dave's driveway was peering through a camera with a lens as big as a toilet bowl. At noon, when Dave stepped outside to feed the bird, he felt like an aquarium showman, thinking he should climb onto the bird feeder and hold the worms between his fingers so the bird could pluck them out on the fly. On Sunday, a man arrived from the airport in a limousine, ran into the backyard, saw the bird, jumped back in the limousine, and headed back to the airport. Didn't even close the door. The limousine never shut off its motor. Dave never found out where he was from. Someone said Pennsylvania. Someone else said Halifax. "Not unusual," said an older man who Dave recognized as one of the group who'd been standing in his driveway the morning it had been raining. He was wearing sneakers and a rumpled canvas hat. He gestured over his shoulder where the limousine had been. We call them twitchers. When they get close to whatever bird it is they're trying to add to their list and they're not sure if they're going to see it or not, they start to twitch. It was late on the afternoon, and there was only this man in his driveway and an older woman in the alley. "You watch her long enough," said the man in the driveway, "and you get to know her habits." "She likes to fly in from the right," said Dave. "Out of the hedge," said the man. "I reckon she comes every 15 minutes or so." And as they stood there looking, the little bird flicked out of the hedge and landed on the feeder. She looked around rapidly, knocked back a few worms, flew off. "She feeds more in the morning," said Dave. Old man nodded. "This is a crippling view," he said. "Cosmic. A lot of people would call it a CMF. "Not on this show," said Dave. "I understand," said the old man. It was like that for 3 weeks. 3 weeks. And then instead of trailing off, it got worse. Someone from one of the television stations did a feature on Dave's bird, and that was the weekend when people who weren't even interested in birds started coming. They wanted to be there because they'd heard a lot of other people had been there, and they didn't want to miss anything. One of them who had come in from the suburbs chewed Dave out. "Doesn't look special to me," he said. "I drove all the way from Brampton. It's not like it's an eagle or something. I'll bet that bird's never killed anything in its life." The second time that happened, Dave called the hotline and said, "The bird's gone. Could you take the bird off your list, please?" That was the beginning of March. Bert hadn't left, of course. The bird stayed all winter, and all winter Dave continued to feed her three times a day. He spent over $200 on mealworms this winter. And he came to know her well. He felt she belonged to him somehow. She was a woodland bird in the middle of the city, way off course, and she had landed at his feeder, and he felt proud that he had seen her through the winter, that he had kept her alive. He felt affection for her. He knew this was sentimentality. He knew the bird didn't feel anything about him. If anything, he was just another intrusion in the backyard, and Lord knows there were enough of those. But last Tuesday, when Dave went out and counted the worms, and none were missing, he knew that she was gone, and he felt sad. He was heartbroken, although he realized the bird had probably migrated, and that was the best thing for her. So on that morning last week, when Dave got up early, he went back to bed with the coffee, and he sat in bed with the unread paper beside him, and he wondered if maybe he would see his bird again in the fall, thinking that whatever else she had felt a sense of home. She could have left any time she wanted, and now she had. Just like everyone else who's ever had a home, she had followed that universal urge to leave. Of all the mysteries of migration, maybe that's the only true thing, the one true thing that we know and share with animals, big and small, this sense of seeking, finding, leaving, but above all, returning home.